So welcome everyone to another Dharma talk. And yesterday's talk on meditation, describing how to use the breathing as a meditation object, and also made quite clear, don't go to the breath too early. If you go to the breath too early, you can't really focus on it, except with force. Eventually it will become very easy, eventually it comes to you, the breathing, because it's just what happens when the mindfulness starts to increase, when the body starts to relax. There's some other points about the breathing which I wanted to mention before I go further. That to watch the breathing is usually a very comfortable, a very pleasant thing to watch. And I often try to get some insights into why watching the breath is nice and easy and pleasant. And one of the possible solutions which came up was the fact that you all, each one of you, spent the first years of your conscious life either in your mum's womb or on her belly just breastfeeding. And you feel that gentle rhythm of the chest going up and down with the breathing from the very earliest times of your life. And it was a time of safety, security, comfort, no stress. And because of that, deep down psychologically, the breathing for nearly everybody is a very comfortable, reassuring rhythm to observe. It's just pacifying. And so that is one of the reasons why we can actually focus on the breathing, we can watch it, and it just relaxes us. And the other reason why the breath is a natural part of the meditation practice is even if you don't go looking for the breathing comes to you. Because it's the only thing left moving. I never emphasized this yesterday, but now I am going to emphasize it. And it gives you another idea of what this meditation is all about, how it works and why it works. Yesterday I was focusing on how by being still, by doing very little, by relaxing, you actually increase the power of mindfulness, so you can see more, and what you see is happier, more beautiful. And that's one very beautiful way of looking at meditation, increasing the power of mindfulness through stillness, through relaxation, through doing very little, coming on retreat, from getting away from all the busyness of your world. That will increase the mindfulness, and that's a very pleasant, wonderful thing to experience. That is going to happen automatically for you, either a lot or a little, but certainly your mindfulness will increase enormously over 9 days, and you will feel that. But as well as that, I did mention in passing the fact that when you meditate, parts of your body and parts of other things, they disappear from your consciousness. It is like the vanishing of things. And it did remind me of that in one of the questions, and I say the questions, sometimes you can't answer all the questions totally because there are too many of them. You can't go into sufficient detail, but when there is one or two which I remember in the morning, I will just answer them a bit more fully. And they were mentioning the times, I mentioned this, when you were meditating in a Zen monastery and facing the white wall. And this was when I was a Buddhist as a young man. And it was so hard to get any place where you could meditate. There's no choice, basically. So any retreat, anywhere in UK, I would go to. And this was in a Zen monastery. And I'd never been to a Zen monastery before. That was, again, where they used the stick, and when the guy next to me got hit, and that woke me up for the rest of the weekend. No more sleepiness after that. But I was told, I'd never done this before, to... You sit facing the wall, and it was an old converted barn in some farmhouse in the north of UK. And to face the wall and keep your eyes open. And you weren't given any other instructions than that. And so, I didn't know what I was doing, and I could meditate before. But something really strange happened. Because I'd learned how to let go of past and future, which is common to all forms of meditation, I was sitting there just watching this white wall, nice and peaceful, not thinking about past or future or girlfriends or fantasizing, just watching it and see what would happen. And then something strange happened. It was very weird, and I realized that this is one of the reasons why you keep your eyes open facing the white wall in this type of meditation. I was sitting there after about 15 minutes, reasonably peaceful, watching this white wall, and then the wall vanished. It just wasn't there anymore. And I was, this was in the early 70s, just after the 60s. And of course, you know, people of that generation, anything weird was really cool. So I thought, wow, you know, did they put something, you know, some drugs, you know, in the porridge this morning? What's going on? But this is really weird and great, marvelous. So you weren't scared, you were almost encouraged from that generation that anything weird was, you know, exciting and useful. So there you were, watching, and the water vanished. But I also had a training in science, so you contemplated afterwards, why did the wall vanish? And it wasn't that hard to understand why. And it was understanding just basic neurology. You don't need to be a neuroscientist, a professor, to understand this. Basic neurology. Your brain is only wired. It's made to notice things which change. If something remains stable, it doesn't move, your brain just doesn't pay attention to it anymore. It literally disappears from your conscious awareness. And of course, you all have many experiences of that. The sound of the aircon. Now you can hear it. And I guarantee that sound is not going to change of the aircon, but in maybe 2 or 3 minutes, you won't be able to hear it anymore. Simply because it's a constant sound, and your brain, maybe through evolution, has decided it's a waste of time processing things which aren't going to change. After a while, you literally can't hear it anymore. And same with some feelings in the body. And again, go to the saliva in your throat again. The sensation, the taste, whatever it is, hasn't changed. Now you can perceive it. In a few minutes, you won't be able to notice it anymore because it's not changing. Your brain only notices things which change. So because I was staring at a white wall, paying attention to it instead of paying attention to thinking, after a few minutes, actually quite a lot of minutes, 15 minutes, the brain turned off. The sense of seeing. Basically, nothing was going on, a waste of time, so it stopped. Now that's really similar to what happens on your computer screens. If you don't click the mouse, if you don't do something, after 5 minutes, however long it is, the screen goes blank. It turns off. Exactly how your brain works. Now that is an important thing to understand, which explains a lot about meditation, and why stillness is important. Because when things become still, when it doesn't move, things disappear. And that is the one of the great things of Buddhism or meditation. When they disappear, you're free of them. You get this wonderful feeling of not having to worry about anything because those things have vanished and you don't need to be concerned about them anymore. You're free. And how this actually happens, that first of all you sit down and you spend a lot of time relaxing the body until the body feels good. When it feels good, it doesn't change. You know, the feeling of delight is there for minute after minute after minute, and after a while you can't notice it anymore. And the reason is because it doesn't change. If you've got an ache or a pain, that does throb. You know, it does itch a bit more and a bit less. It changes, which is why you can't really let go of it. It's just impossible for it to disappear from your consciousness. Although people who have chronic pain, you know, and I don't wish this on anybody, have really great chronic pain, so after a while they just get used to it. And I really wonder whether it's really getting used to it, or because it's always there, the brain basically turns off from the chronic pain. Yeah, they could notice it when they pay attention to it, but the rest of the time it's just always there, so the brain doesn't notice it anymore. Not in a way that you would notice pain. So when we are relaxing the body, we keep it pretty still. And then that's why the body vanishes. Because nothing much is happening there. There's nothing dangerous, there's nothing uncomfortable, you're comfortable there, and the feeling is constant, and then it vanishes. And it's such a wonderful thing, especially the older you get, for your body to disappear. Even if you're reasonably healthy, there's always something going on. You got an itch on your shoulder, an itch on your ear. You have to rearrange your hands under your blanket. You have to lift up your head. And I'm just describing what I'm seeing here. Every now and again, just watch people and see how they can't become still. They have to cough, they have to move their hands, and they have to wipe their nose. And this is normal. Just we take all this movement for granted. You know, we have to wipe our eyebrow and just also scratch our cheek. So look how people are always moving. I do the same. There's nothing wrong with this. But you notice just how this body is always demanding a scratch, an itch, go to the toilet, drink some water in the other end. It is endless. But when the body disappears, you don't have to move, and that's when you can really relax. Every now and again, when you are listening to a talk, just look around and see what people are doing. And how many people can actually be still, sit still? Not even I can do that when I'm talking. Only when I'm meditating, when my body vanishes, only then can I be still. And because only then you can be still, that is the time that great healing can happen. Because you're still, now the body can do its stuff. Otherwise, you know, when we're scratching our eyelids, scratching our cheek, whatever you're doing, I'm just describing again what I'm seeing. So, you know, this is natural, you know, scratching your hair. This is quite natural, this is just what happens. And it is because the body is always demanding attention. But because it happens all the time, we don't really notice that. But when the body vanishes, then you're really free. That's when you can fully relax. You know that, I don't know too much about medicine, there's a few doctors here, but you do know that quite often they put people in induced coma in order to allow healing to happen. You know, simply because that when they're involved, they always tend to tense up, do stuff, and just stop the healing happening. And that's why a lot of times, so when we absolutely do nothing, when our body is still, some of the greatest therapies actually happen to us automatically. But also, it just feels good. You're not bothered by this body anymore. You're totally free of it. So that starts to be what happens. So the body vanishes. But well, other thing which keeps us occupied is all this past and future business, all this thinking. But what happens if you try and keep the thinking mind still? As I was mentioning yesterday, if you have lots and lots of thoughts, two ways of overcoming those thoughts which go on and on and on is the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra, putting spaces between the words. And the other way is starting to feel the body or listening to sounds, listening to the sound of the birds in the morning, or just watching just the sunset, getting into nature instead of thinking about it. And there's a classic story there, which I should have said yesterday, and I keep on repeating this, but this is the best simile for me, because when I heard this, that just opened up the importance of silence. And that if you want to be wise, you want to find out truth, you want to find out the solutions to things, please stop thinking. It's the thinking which stops you being smart. And that was the story of the Taoist master Lao Tzu go on a walk with one of his disciples every evening, and he chose this new guy, this new young man, to go with a walk on him. But he insisted on a golden rule: you weren't allowed to talk on the walk with the master, not one word. And this evening they got to a ridge in the mountains at sunset. And it was a beautiful sunset, and this young disciple forgot the rule and blurted out, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He's spoken. And Lao Tzu turned around, walked back to the monastery, and as soon as he got back and the rule was over, he could speak again. He said, "That young man will never, ever, throughout the rest of his life, be allowed to go on a walk with me. He broke the rule." At which people said, "That's a bit tough. For the rest of his life, can't you just ban him for 6 months or a year or something? For the rest of his life, that's going too far. And what's wrong anyway with saying what a beautiful sunset?" And that's when Lao Tzu replied, "When that student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words." That's what happens when we think about things. When we think, beautiful stars at night, we're not watching the stars anymore, we're watching the thoughts. And that's a different ball game altogether. So if you live in the world of thoughts, you're not watching life anymore. You're just watching thoughts. That's why intellectuals these days, they know thoughts so well, but they don't know life. And in the other metaphor, the thoughts, the descriptions, the commentary, they're the signposts. They point out where things are. For example, they will point out the toilets, you know, men's toilet, women's toilet. Have you seen those signs on the toilets here? But the sign isn't the toilet. You don't urinate on the door. The sign tells you there's a toilet inside. The sign tells you where to go. But so many intellectuals, they literally do urinate on the door. Because they don't know where the toilet is. They mistake the signpost for the thing itself. That's the difference between saying what a beautiful sunset and actually seeing it. Now when you understand that, you understand why it's so important to be silent. Why all wisdom comes from silence. Philosophers think a lot, but how wise are they? Monks, people like Ajahn Chah, 4 years of education. He's not a really good thinker at all. And that was one of my first experiences with that monk. I had just come from this big university, Cambridge, one of the best in the world. Theoretical physics, that's one of the hardest subjects in one of the best universities. I was really smart, I was intelligent, until I came across this guy. And look, he made me look like a total stupid grade one failure compared to him. It really sort of shook me. And I thought, all these years of learning how to think, and how stupid I was in life. And this guy was just so wise in life. Just some of the things he did was just blew my mind. And that started me realizing that wisdom comes from silence, not from thinking. So when you start learning how to see rather than to think, how to feel rather than give comments about things, then you know the door is not the toilet. It's a sign. There's a toilet inside. So open the door, go past the words, into the thing itself. And then you can understand just how to be a little bit peaceful, a bit still. So once you get past there, this is the basis of mindfulness, and then you're really taking off. And it's so easy then to watch things like the breath. But first of all, if you've got present moment awareness and silence, all this stuff disappears. And you're sitting there, nothing is moving, you're not thinking. What's left? The breathing is left. That's still moving. In fact, there's two things which are moving. It's your heartbeat and your breath. And unfortunately, going to the heartbeat is a sort of a dead end. You can't get any further if you just follow the heartbeat. So don't go looking at the heartbeat because that's moving. Hopefully, by that time, you're calm enough. The heartbeat is very soft anyway. So, you know, just let the heart do the beating. But the breath is what most people are usually aware of. They're sitting here, letting go of the past and the future. The body's nice and relaxed. It starts to disappear. The past and future disappears. And the only thing left moving is the breathing. So a lot of time, this is how I practice. I don't ever go looking for my breath. The breath always comes to me. So I'm just sitting here, just relaxing my body, letting go of the past and future. No more thinking. And then you just become aware of your breath. It's natural because it's the only thing moving. And I know that a difference. When I go looking for my breath, okay, breathe in, breathe out, come on, I jump around, just notice the breath. It's always unnatural. But when I just sit here and just relax and let go, do nothing, and the breath comes to me, and then it's always natural and very much more peaceful. Because I'm not interfering with it. It just comes to me. Who's the only thing left moving? Now, a lot of times in meditation, people will ask, what do I do now? You know, you get to the next stage of meditation, what do I do? Ajahn Brahm, yeah, I've got stage 3, now I'm on stage 4, 5 or 6. I hate these ideas of stages, you know, just, because then you start comparing yourself with your friend in the evening. Where did you get to that? I got to stage 5. Oh, that's nothing. I got to stage 5 on the first. I'm on stage 6. Stage 6. Oh, that's nothing. You get what's called spiritual materialism. You know, just comparing your attainments with others, which is just, that's gomayang again. This is rubbish. And you should never get compared. There's no such thing as stages. So it's just we say these things to give you some idea of where you are, but don't take these things seriously. So you just, you're with this, this silence, a breath comes to you. And it just relaxes by itself. You're just sitting there. And you say, what do you do? At every stage of meditation, you do absolutely nothing. But then people say, well, how do I do nothing? Come on, you don't do anything. Well, how do I not do anything? How do I do not doing? And you can see the difficulty here because we're always used to doing something. And it's just so hard not to do anything. It just goes totally against the grain. Now, you're coming here to meditate. No, you're not coming here to meditate. You're not coming to meditate, not doing anything. I told someone yesterday in the interviews, the last instructions, I said, don't meditate. What do you mean? It's a meditation retreat. I said, don't meditate. Just don't do anything. And then meditation happens. So if you do the meditation, you're going to get stressed out. You don't do it. You're just sitting there watching. And it happens. That is the truth of the thing. So you say, what should I do at this stage? Nothing. Yeah, but, you know, how do I do nothing? Oh, it gives me such headaches. So, in order to understand this, you know, we got these little tricks. You know, it's, we sort of convince you you are doing something, but actually you're doing nothing. But it makes you feel good. So that's when you can see on the back of some t-shirts, say, make peace. Be kind, be gentle. Oh, great, now I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to make peace, be kind, be gentle. But actually making peace, what is peace? You're not fighting anything. You're making peace with whatever's happening right now. You're at peace with it, which is another word for doing nothing. Make peace, be kind. You know my definition of kindness? You open the door of your heart, whatever's happening right now, good, bad, who cares, welcome. Being kind is actually doing nothing. You're letting it be. You know, you're not getting angry and upset about, you know, any irritation. You open the door. Irritation is a part of life. Come in. It's another word for not doing anything. And being gentle, another word for not doing anything. I usually add sometimes a fourth quality, being patient. What is patience anyway, but not doing anything? So, but you think, patience, that's something I can do. Kindness, yeah, something I can develop. But actually, really, it's doing absolutely nothing. Just sitting there, like a Buddha, and doing nothing. Because you're doing nothing, the path develops. In order to explain this again, I travel a lot. And sometimes, you know, in these aircraft, it's really boring. So sometimes you pick up the in-flight magazine, which is really boring. Except once, on good old Air Asia, I picked up the magazine there, and it was a joke. It was a good joke. So thank you, Air Asia. And the joke was about, as a pilot, he was describing the aircraft of the future. He said, the aircraft of the future will be totally automated. Now, because, like, human beings' reaction times are far slower than, computers. Computers can react, you know, to turbulence or some danger within a fraction of a second. A human being takes at least half a second to react. So the computer can react much faster. And it doesn't have these human errors, you know, which causes many crashes. So he said, in the future, the cockpit of an aircraft will have just two beings inside. One will be the pilot, another one will be a dog. And the job of the pilot in the aircraft of the future is to feed the dog. And the job of the dog is to bite the pilot if he touches anything. And that's the aircraft of the future. Totally automated with a dog and a pilot, and that's all. The dog's job is to bite the pilot if he touches anything. And the pilot's job is to feed the dog. That's funny, but it also, it'd be great if I could put a dog in your mind to bite you if you did anything. Okay, you've got the beautiful breath, and you say, what should I do? The dog bites you. Stop doing stuff. Because that's the, you can get the idea of what's happening here. So you get to the delight, the breath, and you don't do anything. It just happens. It just develops by itself when you're not doing stuff. And then as it develops, I said yesterday, what happens? It just gets very delightful because you're not doing anything. And you don't need a commentary, okay? You don't need to sort of take notes. You know, people are great note takers. You don't need to take notes because it all gets brainwashed inside of you. You don't need to remember anything. You know, I was with Ajahn Chah for many years, and I never took notes. We didn't have paper or pencils to write with. It was, man, we really were poor monasteries in those days. It was great to have such a simple lifestyle. And you never took notes, but it's incredible how much of what he said you remembered. If it was important, it goes in there. So you don't need to take notes. You don't need to try and remember. And what it happens is you don't take notes and you don't try and work it all out. Again, because I was trained as a scientist, I had learned you don't work out the experiment until all of the data is in. The job of an experiment in science is just to take all the readings and don't even think about them. Because if you start thinking about them, then you make all these connections, you make your conclusion when only half the data is in, and the rest of the data, if it doesn't fit with your conclusion, you know, anomaly, you wipe it out. And sometimes you change some of these other readings to fit your theory. It's just the nature of human beings. So I was taught, no, when you're taking the readings and experiment, you write down all those readings, you record everything, and you don't think about them at all. Don't try and work out what they mean until all the data is in. And once you have all the data, then you can contemplate them and find out, you know, what they mean. Plot them on a graph, find out what's happening, but not halfway through the experiment. And I use that for my meditation. I don't go contemplating the meaning of life right in the middle of the experiment of the meditation. I wait till the end, and then I work out what it means, not in the middle. So that means you are silent. You don't need to work things out yet. Just get the peace, get the stillness, get the data coming in, the data of peace and stillness. Just do it silently. No need to interrupt. And then what happens? The breath becomes so incredibly beautiful. Now, that beauty in meditation is crucial. Because many people, it seems to be the problem with people these days, maybe just our modern culture, we're afraid of happiness, basically. And what that means is we don't allow ourselves to be happy. You know, sometimes I tell jokes to people and I see them. They want to laugh, but they, you know, they're too proud to laugh. So I'm much better than this. I don't laugh at silly jokes. You know, I am far more intelligent to laugh at a silly joke. And you can see them there. Inside, they want to laugh, but their conceit stops them. Everybody says, even a bad joke, any opportunity to laugh and smile and be happy, I'll take it. I'm not sort of fussy when it comes to smiling. Any reason will do for me. And because of that, you know, that you develop much more happiness in your life, but also in your meditation. So when happiness comes, you embrace it. You don't think inside, something must be wrong, I'm feeling happy. Or like this nun who came and stayed years ago. Much of the wisdom of these teachings comes from real life stories. She was getting into such deep, deep meditation during a retreat, and I really expected her to go all the way. And then she came across a blockage. She couldn't get any further. And I tried everything I knew to try and help her through this obstacle. And then eventually she told me what the obstacle was. She let it out. And she said, I don't think I deserve to be so happy. And that just really is a knife to my heart. You know, that's so common to many people. Somewhere in your life, you know, you've been criticized, put down, you're not good enough. When enlightenment comes to you, you reject it because you think you don't deserve it. Oh, don't do that, please. You all deserve enlightenment, you all deserve happiness. And it's one of the reasons why I started giving out these happiness licenses to people. I printed them out on letterhead, just like a license you get from the government. Say, happiness license. This license allows the holder, and I put your name down there, permission to be happy at any time, for any reason or no reason in particular, signed Ajahn Brahm. And it works. You know, people put that in their offices or next to their bed. And why it needs to have somebody you respect to give you permission to be happy, that's really ridiculous, but sometimes that's what you need. You know, if you were a Christian, I'd get God to sign it. God permits you to be happy. Oh, thank you. Because when happiness comes, sometimes we just reject it. We think something is wrong. You remember how many religions are anti-happiness? Obviously, you know, some of the extremist Muslims are, but they never started this. The Puritans. You know, that's somebody once gave, you know, the Puritans, these fundamentalist Christians in the Middle Ages, you know, Oliver Cromwell and all those people. And who was it? Calvin. And the Puritans, they were described by this, you know, very wise philosopher. He said, Puritanism is the fear that somewhere, someone is happy. That you can't be happy. If you're happy, you're going to go to hell or something. And that's the negative part of religion. You see, that's still alive today, unfortunately, that people are afraid of happiness. And they think that being happy is a sin. It's the work of the devil. And Buddhists have that too, especially Buddhists in the West. Happiness comes, you think something must be wrong. So much so that you may hear it, even from monks and teachers. If you get happy, you'll get attached to it. And the point is, you are supposed to get attached to happiness. I mentioned the other day, there is some things to let go of, some things to be attached to. And I gave the simile, if you're on the back of a motorbike, that's something to be attached to when it's moving. Don't let go. When it stops, then you can let go of it. But there's many things in life to be attached to, and happiness is one of the great vehicles of meditation. So when happiness comes, get attached to it. And for those of you who have any doubts whatsoever, I can show you one of the great Buddhist teachings. It's in the Parsādhika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, where the Buddha explained, if people ask you, well, you monks, next he was talking to monks, he meant nuns as well, you're just attached to happiness, meditating there, blissing out. You should say, yes, we are attached to happiness of meditation. But also add, anyone attached to the happiness of meditation can only expect four consequences. This is the teaching of the Buddha. This is what happens to you. Only one of these four things, no more than these four things. This is what happens if you get attached to the pleasure of meditation. Stream-winning, once returning, non-returning, full enlightenment. The four stages of enlightenment. Said the Buddha, that's what happens to you if you get attached to the happiness of meditation. You get enlightened. That's what you're supposed to do. So that's why attachment to the happiness of meditation is encouraged by the Buddha. So when it comes up, great. Enjoy it. So much of life is tough. So much of life is difficult and painful and disappointing and with grief, frustration, disappointment, not living up to what you expect. And you get happiness in meditation? Free happiness. No bad side effects. It's not illegal. You don't have to pay tax on the happiness in meditation. It's good for your health, proved again and again with all these studies. You know, so much other things you enjoy in life is always bad for you. Cholesterol, diabetes, or, you know, some other disease. How many diseases are happiness diseases in life? You indulge in it and it's bad for you. But meditation is free. It's got all the health ticks from the Heart Foundation, Cancer Foundation, Diabetics. It's got all the ticks for you. And it's free. You can have as much as you like. And it's really good. It also gets you enlightened as well. So, when it starts to come up, encourage it. So you're sitting here and you're happy. Please don't think, what's wrong? Please don't think, oh, I don't deserve this. You know, there's many people suffering in this world. I should suffer as well. Please don't think like that. Other people want you to be happy. At least that's one less suffering person in the world, you. So you're happy then. Happiness is contagious. Just like misery is contagious. So imagine if everyone is miserable in this room. Then I will become miserable too. So now I try and make some happiness up. You know, it's contagious. You get happy. We all get happy. And even the kangaroos get happy. And the birds get happy. Everyone gets happy. So it's a great thing for other people to be happy. So when it comes up, encourage it. So this is what the Buddha said, piti sukha. Happiness comes up in your meditation. It's supposed to come up. It's supposed to be developed. So when it's up there, you're watching the breath, and you're so happy, having a great time. Great. Enjoy. Because if that happiness doesn't come up, then when the body vanishes, you go into a dull state. Basically, you know, it's darkness, blackness, you know, you can't see anything, don't know what to do, and it all falls apart. But if you develop the happiness, then you get this delightful breath, which is so sweet, so delicious. And then when the breath vanishes, that's when you're left with the happiness. Your mindfulness is strong. The sign of strong mindfulness is this happiness. And without that strong mindfulness, you can't really develop the next stage. Because the next stage, you see these beautiful lights in the mind. They're beautiful. It's because your mindfulness is strong. If your mindfulness is weak, it's basically you go out into the darkness, you can't see anything. Your eyes aren't wide enough to collect all the light. So when the breath disappears, with it the whole body, you're not bright enough. The mindfulness is not strong enough to see what happens when the breath disappears, which is why you've got to develop the happiness. It's also why I tell jokes, why I do three sadhus, why I try and just, you know, tell funny stories and laugh at you because I want you to laugh back, so that brings up the happiness. And this meditation retreat, you know, becomes a nice happy retreat, and you're having a great time. I'm developing that happiness, encouraging it, so that when you get to that stage of delightful breath, it's really delightful. And when it disappears, you're left with these beautiful lights. So why are you teddy bear meditation? Teddy bears make you happy. I don't know why. You know, I'm a grown man. I'm over 60 now. But I cuddle a teddy bear. You know, I really like it. So you get the teddy bear. There's two of them over there. So get the teddy bear and cuddle it, and you get happiness up. If you really like, you can't go to sleep well at night. As few people can't sleep well at night. Get a teddy bear, take it to bed with you. Cuddle it in bed. I guarantee you'll have a really happy night. The teddy bear. So what it really does, it brings you this happiness, this joyful mind. And when that joyful mind comes up, when the breath vanishes, you get these beautiful lights coming up in the mind. They're called nimittas. It's a stage in meditation. In Anapanasati Sutra, it's number 9 stage, but don't call it a stage, it just happens. When people see these lights, they ask me, what should I do? Oh God, haven't you been listening? Just enjoy, stay there, make peace, be kind, be gentle, whatever it is, any excuse to do nothing. And just, because when you do something, those nimittas move, and they lose their power. Because what those nimittas are, the lights you see in the mind, that's a reflection of your sixth sense, the mind. Now, five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, five senses have gone. They've been subdued. You see this beautiful light in the mind. Sometimes that light can come up when the five senses are still active, but they're so weak and the mind has become so strong because of, you know, all your practice. Yeah, the nimitta can appear even though the five senses haven't really totally disappeared. And even, this is weird, but you know, this happens. If you get really lots and lots of deep meditation, your mind gets so powerful that sometimes you're eating your lunch. There's a big nimitta up there. You've got to eat through the nimitta. The mind is so strong, it's there. And the other senses are active, but the mind is so strong, it dominates. That's a really incredible thing to be aware of. But for most of you, that won't happen for a few years. Great if it happens on this retreat, then you'd be really blissing out. But, you know, the mind usually has to only appears when the five senses are either totally subdued or just 99% subdued. You see this beautiful light coming up. It's a reflection of that sixth sense. So if the mind, if you move, that nimitta moves. If you do stuff, the nimitta loses its energy and it just burns out, it just vanishes. So your job is actually to be as still as possible. When I started developing nimittas, they would be moving around. They were bright enough, but they kept on moving around. It was so hard to keep them still. Until I, you know, what I realized, you know, because it was, you know, I was meditating a lot and didn't know really sort of what to do. And then one morning I was shaving in the mirror, and I realized that, you know, whenever I moved, the image in the mirror moved. And that was that the insight, just from ordinary life, I get it. Because, you know, that nimitta is like image of your mind. So if you move, the image moves. And if I'm shaving, it's a waste of time holding the mirror still, you know, when I'm still moving, you know, the image will still keep moving. So I realize you don't hold the mirror still. You, if you're like the one who's watching, has to be perfectly still. And then your nimitta becomes still. It just stays there. Nothing moves. And that's when it really starts to build up energy. And that's when this nimitta gets incredibly bright. And I mentioned this, somebody mentioned last night, sometimes it gets so bright, it's like you're blinded. It's like looking at the sun. Only the sun is nowhere near as bright as these nimittas. But please remember, because I had that experience to think I'm going to go blind. And that's not the reason why I'm wearing glasses, because I've been watching too many nimittas. No, you don't go blind. This is just old age. Just, you're not seeing it with your physical eyes. The physical eyes are turned off. It's with the mind, and the mind doesn't go blind. So you can take as much brilliance as you like. As much, and with the brilliance comes bliss, as much bliss as you like. And it's not disturbing, it's as powerful, it's peaceful. So let it come. Don't do anything, and please, don't be afraid. Because many people, when they get these nimitta states, you get into some really deep and powerful meditation. So many people get afraid. Oh, no, not for me, I'm not a monk. And you get this beautiful free gift, and you just reject it. Please don't do that. You don't need to be afraid. There's no danger at all. Actually, those of you who have heard me before, you know this. There is one danger of really getting into the nimittas and getting into the jhanas which come next. There is one danger. I have to be honest. I have to let you know. And that danger is, if you do lots of deep meditation, lots of jhanas, you will probably lose all your hair. You'd end up a monk or a nun. That's the only danger. That's no real danger. But you don't go crazy, you just get enlightened, that's all. And you know, if you don't even get enlightened, you get so wise, so free. All greed and anger and fear and grief, they tend to just vanish. They're not there anymore for you. You go way beyond those things. So you get this beautiful light, keep it still, and it gets really brilliant by itself. Now, when people first get these nimittas, I don't know why this is. It just shows just how much lack of self-worth people have. Because everybody, it seems, they come up and said, no, it couldn't have been a nimitta. Not me. You know, I've only just started meditating. You know, I'm not a really good person. I'm not even a Buddhist. There can't be a nimitta. And they come and talk to me about it, and this is just anecdotes of someone who's been teaching this for a long time now. 95%, probably even more than that, of people, when they get a nimitta, or they think they've got a nimitta, it actually is a nimitta. It's very rare that they're imagining it. And I say this is one of the reasons why I designed this retreat center, and I designed this hall here, to make sure the windows are very high. So if you're facing this way, you are not. This is not the sun coming in. It's not a headlight of a car. No one's using flashlight. It's an imitator, okay? It is true that in the morning the sun comes through that window over there. So if you're facing that way, you might see an imitator about 6:15. And that is a fake one. But a lot of times you're not facing that direction. It's a real thing. Well done. Why pull yourself down and say it can't be? Not me. Other people, yeah, but not me. No, you as well. And look, it's incredible. Just the number of people who actually get deep meditation in this place. And you know, they're the least expected. There's some people who have, you know, they've never meditated much before in their lives. And I remember the last person who got these deep meditations, well, maybe about a year ago. I think maybe it was a year ago, the Easter retreat, no, it could have been January Easter retreat last year. This guy came here with lots of tattoos. And I thought he was some bikie gang leader. I thought he'd got in the wrong place. my fault, okay. I admit I judged him just because of his looks. But he was the one who got jhanas on the retreat. And he came. I was really gobsmacked. He came up to me in the interview and he said, I just had his experiences. And, you know, just by his demeanor, you know, something had happened. And he described it and said, my goodness, yeah, that's the real thing. Well done. And of all the people in the retreat, he was the last person I expected. He's the one who got it. So, it happens to people. So you don't know who's it going to be. It's just person, they do the instructions, they follow it, and it just happens. They just really get blissed out and they just really go into some deep states. So, there you've got the beautiful lights. Don't be afraid. Now you're going to get a lot of power. It's the control freaks get afraid because they're really having to let go full on now. They can't control at all. And why do you control anyway? Because you're afraid what will happen if you stop controlling things. So at this particular stage, I give this simile of it's like you're driving a car. And I'm in the passenger seat next to you, driving in busy traffic, and I say, okay, now take your hand off the steering wheel. Take your feet off the pedals. I can't, there's traffic all around me. Take your hand off the steering wheel. Feet off the pedals. And they do. And the car goes in the traffic perfectly, without them needing to steer anything. That's what it's like when you meditate. And in one of the last retreats, this girl came up to me one morning, interviews, and she said, I had a dream last night. And in the dream, I was in the car, the driver, and you were in the passenger seat. But we weren't going in traffic, we were going over a cliff. And in the dream, she said, and you told me, take your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, don't touch the brake. And I said, I can't, we're going to die, we're going over a cliff. She said, take your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. And so she did, in her dream. Good girl. And we careened over the cliff. And she could see there was a road at the bottom of the cliff, but a very sharp right turn. And she wanted to grab the steering wheel. I said, leave the steering wheel alone. Let go. We went 1,000 miles an hour down the cliff face. We hit the bottom. And automatically the car turned right and went perfectly along the road. I said, yes. So she got, you know, in her dreams, she actually got it. Not in real life though, but anyway, at least in the dreams. So that was what was happening to her. And that's exactly what you do. You don't have to be afraid. In meditation, you're perfectly safe. Now, if you think you're not safe, I always like telling a few more little stories. Now, one is from the text, one is what person I knew in real life. In the texts, in the time of the Buddha,
there was this monk who would get into these really deep meditations. And he was meditating so deeply in the jungle, sitting down there, meditating. And these two villagers were collecting wood or mushrooms in a forest somewhere. And they saw this monk sitting perfectly still. Really still. So still, they thought the monk had died. Because sometimes that's what it looks like. When you get into deep meditation, you can't even see, you know, your chest rise and fall. You hardly need any breath at all. Actually, in one stage, you actually stop breathing. But you're perfectly okay. So they thought, oh my goodness, the monk, he's dead. And we're Buddhists. We can't just leave him out here to get eaten by the jungle animals. That's not respectful. So what should we do? And they talked with each other and thought, well, let's cremate him. And they were in the jungle. There was wood all around, so it only took them half an hour to collect enough wood for a pyre. And they put the monk on top, and they lit it. And so once it was lit, the flames were going, they realized, you know, nature would take the rest of the course, and he would be burnt and cremated. And they were busy people. You can't hang around all day at funerals, you know, you're busy people. So they left him burned there, and off they went to collect their mushrooms and herbs and stuff, with the poor venerable being cremated. But the next morning, they were in the village, and they got up early, and who would come for alms round in the village but the monk they cremated? Not even his robe was charred. It's perfectly invulnerable. And this is actually the story in the deep meditations. Don't worry if they think you're dead. And if we put you in a box, we send you to the crematorium and they put you in the ovens. Have you been to the crematoriums and seen people put in the ovens? And once you're in the oven, after a few hours of being burnt, then they open the door, and then you say, hi, I'm still here. So the guy who looks after the crematorium, he might die, but you are perfectly safe. Now that was the story of the text. The story of one of my friends, I can tell this now because, you know, he is dead now. That's Sudamo, Indonesian monk. Any of you know him from Indonesia? Long time ago, but I met him first couple of years in Thailand. And straight away, you know, when I first met him, I saw him in Wat Bawan. I was walking out with this monk, Ajahn Menindo. He's now in Northumberland. I turned around and said, that monk's got credible power. You know, could feel it straight away. Because his story was, still a lay person in Java, 40 years ago, when there were still jungles in Java, they're really hard to find now, it's concrete jungle now, most of Java. He went into the jungle just to meditate, to be a bit of a hermit monk, a rusi. And so he found a nice quiet place, sat down and meditated. And he described it to me. I remember him telling me this personally. He said he was meditating, it got very still, and he saw this star come to him. Nimitta, that's what a nimitta, beautiful light. And he said, in the best English he could, he married the star. Totally united into it. And this is what happens. You get these beautiful nimittas, and basically you just join the nimitta. You go right inside of it. It envelops you. You're just one with that nimitta. And then you get that into the jhanas. And when he came out of his meditation, it was a long time afterwards, quite a few days when he came out. And he noticed the jungle had changed. He checked in the village. He'd actually been sitting meditation on a low spot. There'd been a flash flood. And he'd been under a couple of meters of water for days. Totally submerged. But perfectly okay. And he came out afterwards. And no worries at all. So in his jhanas, floods, fires, nothing can harm you. So you don't have to be afraid at all. In fact, if we hear that some comet is heading towards the earth and it's going to hit us, get into jhana quickly. And you'll be safe. There'll be nothing left when you come out, so I don't know what you're going to do next. But you are dying because of the comet. So this is what happens. But it won't happen unless you've got lots of joy. And of course, be prepared for the fear, because these are big states of mind. These are huge stuff. And you're getting to, you know, where the Buddha started to hang out. So it's powerful stuff, but it's real. And any of you who like weird stuff, a lot of people like weird stuff, that monk Sudama, I never saw this myself, but this princess, Thai princess, I was very close to, knew her very well. She was did some meditation under this monk. She said she was meditating like you here, just in an afternoon class, sitting in this Wat Bawon in Bangkok, meditating, and she felt something weird was happening. So she opened her eyes to take a peek. And she said, she absolutely swears, she wouldn't lie to me. She said she saw rays of light coming out of the monk's eyes into another meditator. Just like in the movies, but this was real. Real rays of light. So it's really cool to see things like that every now and again, but I can't tell those things to you unless the guy's dead, because we keep all these things secret. But once people die, then we can let know what goes on. But these things are real, they actually happen, because he had powerful meditation. Really a strong monk. So anyway, this is what happens. You don't need to be afraid. The other thing which happens sometimes is excitement.
Yes, it's happening.
I was so pleased. Once you get excited, just one little bit of excitement and the whole thing falls apart. And you think, oh, why did it? And sometimes it takes years to get back again. So please, when you do get these nimittas, these lights coming up, don't be afraid. Don't get excited. Just do nothing and enjoy to the max. It's incredible for you. And why not? Why can't people do these things? People do these things. Ordinary people, not just monks and nuns, you can do it as well. But you just follow the instructions, which is basically doing nothing. Sitting there, and especially the deeper you go, the more important it is not to interfere with the process. Especially when you get delightful breath, just relax to the max. You're just the observer. You don't do anything. Just in this present moment, not thinking, not taking notes, no excitement, no fear. Just let it happen. Lights come. Beautiful, they get marvelous. Sometimes when these lights come, sometimes they don't center themselves, first of all. I say this because it's really common with you guys. Saves you lining up to ask the questions and interviews. Comes up to the left or the right somewhere on the edge. And what most people do, they go and look for it. And of course it runs away. If it comes into a corner, just wait, do nothing. It's like it's coming to see if you're ready. And then if you are, if you're still, it'll center itself. If you have many things, if it starts to move a lot, pulsate, swirl around, it's because you're moving, you're not still enough. So just relax more, do less, and it will stop moving and just become still. When it becomes still, it becomes very bright. Brighter and brighter, more and more bliss. Enjoy to the max. You have a wonderful time. So that's what happens next. Now, of course, having told you that, you all want it, don't you? And that's going to stop you. Don't want anything. This is good enough. Be content. Easily satisfied. Just being able to see the breath for half an hour, that's good enough for us. But when you don't want it, that's when it comes. That's why I prepare you. Thank you for listening.